It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We'll talk about upgrading to Windows 10. It may not cost you a penny. A wonderfully written new memo from the Department of Homeland Security revealing a new vulnerability disclosure policy. And I think the best programmer comment I've ever seen. That and Strandhog. It's all coming up next. You know what Strandhog means? You'll find out on Security Now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 743, recorded Tuesday, December 3rd, 2019. Android Strandhog. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and privacy and safety and how computers work and whatever, and science fiction, whatever else this man here wants to talk about, because he is the star, and I mean star of our show, Steve Gibson. Hello, Steve.
Leo, great to be with you again. And it was, we had a great time on Saturday.
Man, doing this audience just wrapped, watching every move. The one guy told me, though, I lost him at prime numbers. But in the Steve did a great squirrel presentation, like really detailed squirrel presentation. Not just, you know, how it works, but the genesis of the idea, the deep guts of how it works. You really explained it to everybody. And we had a wonderful studio audience, about 45 people, all went over to Lagunitas afterwards. That was fun, too.
It was. And we had one listener flew in from, believe it or not, from Japan.
Wow.
For this. And
another guy who was at the Boston event came in from Austin. Yeah.
Yeah.
Austin, so right. Boston and Austin. So, yeah, you have some hardcore fans. Took a lot of selfies
so
again.
So we're helping people's frequent flyer miles in every way we can.
I love it. Anyway, it was a lot of fun. If you haven't seen it, it's the first episode on our new events feed at twit.tv/events.
Yeah, I love that. I didn't understand why I got number one, but it's like...
You're number one. You know,
event number one, yay!
Number two, three, four, five, and all the way up to 100 will be CES. And then that's where we're going to put stuff that, you know, is out of the ordinary that we do, Twit events. And then the news feeds will be the breaking news things we do, like the Apple, Google, and Microsoft
right.
announcements, stuff like that. So what's on the agenda this week?
So this is interesting. The title of today's podcast, number 743, is Android Strandhog. With two G's, H-O-G-G, which is a Norwegian word referring to mistreatment by Vikings. And one may wonder how that became our show title. That's because of something really interesting, and it's going to be interesting to see how this evolves. 4 years ago, and we talked about this at the time, there was some research out of Penn State and FireEye, the guys at FireEye Security, noticing that there were some features in Android's multitasking system by design, which they demonstrated could be abused. And Google said, okay, yeah, we don't really think that's a problem. Well, it's now been found in the wild. And it's not good. So anyway, we're going to wrap up by talking about Strandhog, which is the name that was given to the guys who first found it when banks were reporting that their customers' accounts were being drained as a consequence of what Google deliberately put into Android.
Wow.
So
wow.
Makes for a interesting story. But as we approach the end of patching for Windows 7, I wanted to revisit the free upgrade from 7 or 8 to 10, which it turns out can still be done. Also, we have a very important alert for users of HP's SSDs, because they're all going to die. We also have complications that arise with international privacy treaties, which is I found sort of interesting, when end-to-end encryption might be threatened by one of the nations in the treaty, which what really brought me to this is that apparently, there's still rattling their sabers at the DOJ about this and whether they're going to like legislate us out of encryption, which, you know, 2020 may be really interesting. We've also got the U.S. government's formal permission to hack them. That is within the executive branch, believe it or not. We'll see how that goes over. We also have a quick look at a particularly devastating ransomware attack. I'm trying to downplay ransomware, but it's still there. And this one was just like, yikes, ouch. We also have more anti-tracking privacy happiness coming soon by default to Firefox. The never-ending headaches caused by Windows DLLs. An update. I wanted to check back in to see how my joy of sync recommendations and self-determinations have been fitting.
Good. I've been waiting for an update. That's great.
Yeah. And then we're going to wrap up by talking about some questionable multitasking features that Google deliberately has in Android that are now looking as though they're not quite so well advised. So I think another great podcast for our listeners.
Yeah, you're getting good at the teases, because now I just have to listen. I just have to find out.
So our picture of the week is one I've been holding on to for a while, showing a snippet of code at the top of some code. And so this is, you know, we've often talked about how some comments you're writing for yourself, some comments you're writing for whoever it is that gets stuck with the task of maintaining the code that you wrote. And of course, ideally, people who come along later will augment the comments that they find with more to keep them current. Anyway, so this is a comment block that reads, "Dear programmer, when I wrote this code, only God and I knew how it worked. Now, only God knows." It says, "Therefore, if you are trying to optimize this routine and it fails, parens, most surely, close parens, please increase this counter as a warning for the next person." And then the next line shows as a variable, total_hours_wasted_here=, and it's currently set to 254. So anyway, I just thought that was a hoot. So yes, if you encounter this and the count is large, maybe you should consider not bothering to optimize.
Do we know where this came from? This is awesome.
No, I don't. Isn't it great?
Oh,
I love
man.
It.
I love it.
So, okay. It turns out today, even though Windows 10 free upgrade ended on the 29th of July, 2016, you can still upgrade Windows 10 for free. And so I just wanted to mention that because I imagine maybe this month, maybe next month, because after all, as we know, middle of next month, middle of January 2020 is the last update, security update, which Microsoft will be providing for Windows 7. Now we say that assuming that they're going to stick to, and it seems likely that they will, stick to their determination to force anybody who wants more updates into the paid plan for the following 3 years. At the same time, we've seen them reach back even to Windows XP if something really horrific, like Bluekeep in this example, had happened, because, of course, they did go back and patch even Windows XP because the Bluekeep vulnerability in the desktop server was so bad that they wanted to go back and fix it. So so presumably updates stop after the middle of next month, January 2020. And I don't recall exactly what it was, or I didn't know as I was starting to do this research, but I remembered that there was some kind of, I don't know, skeezy way that you could still get an update that didn't really seem copacetic that Microsoft was making available. And I didn't know if that was still available, what was going on. And, of course, it never really was clear to me why this was time-limited in the first place, why they were, after all this massive push, remember there was the, well, of course, my own freeware, Never 10, and then there was also the GWX Get Windows 10 that was, like, unwanted software that was being downloaded that was really pushing people, and for a while you could push it off, and then it sort of stopped giving you a choice. You had to hit the X button to close the dialogue because you then were only left with a choice of upgrade now or upgrade tonight. And it's like, wait, what happened to no thanks? So after all that, then they suddenly said, okay, you know, we're going to give you a deadline. And I guess the point was to like give people the impression that this was really it, and that if you didn't get it now, then you're never going to be able to get it for free. And in fact, if you want Windows 10 Pro, oddly enough, the download Windows 10 takes you to this page where, first of all, they're trying to sell you their Surface hardware because you like fill out a questionnaire about whether Windows is fast or slow, whether you run one thing or more than one thing at a time. It sort of does this weird profiling of you. Basically, the answer always comes up, oh, you should get a Windows, you should upgrade to a Windows Surface thing. But if you answer the questions in some way, then it will also give you the choice of, well, okay, well, we guess if you just upgrade to Windows 10, you'll be happy enough. So it turns out that...
By the way, I don't know what page you're going to, but I don't see that on this page.
Yeah, if you go down...
Windows 10, confirm.
No, I think if you scroll down further, because there was like something about having to get the license to like qualify for a license or purchase
You don't even really need to do that because you don't need a license is the point.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And
yeah.
and that ends up being the case.
I didn't have to do any of that. I'm just going to download right here the ISO 64-bit. The key is, in the past, we've always thought, well, if you do that, you're going to have to enter a serial number.
Correct. And they say you're going to.
And they say you're going to, but you don't.
Yes. And are you running this from Windows 7?
Oh, this is on a Mac.
Oh, okay. So maybe it's different if you're running it from Windows 7.
There may be other entry points. I just Googled Windows Media Creator Tool and went right to that page. There may be other entry points that you've gone through.
I created a shortcut for our listeners, grc.sc/win10. So that takes you to, that's just a shortcut, to the official Windows 10 software download, which does eventually take you to the Media Creators Tool. That's where it gets to.
Yeah. See, don't follow your link. Just Google Media Creation Tool. It take me right there. This is the number one link, and I didn't have any of that crap. It's a simple click. So I think you're maybe going in through a sales portal of some kind.
Create Windows 10 installation media.
Maybe you're right. Maybe if you're on Windows 7, it has a sense. But in any event, you don't need to have a key. It'll download
right.
It for you. Their theory is, well, you're going to download a trial version. Eventually, you'll need a key. You'll have to activate it in, I think, 90 days. But apparently not.
Yes. And in fact, Ed Bott, who we know over at ZDNet, he was curious about all this. He wrote that he had decommissioned a machine back in 2017, a little Intel small form factor PC, and he was curious about the whole upgrade process. And so he went through this process and was told that he was going to have, you know, like purchase a license to Windows 10. But to his surprise, as he wrote, once he went through this upgrade process, he was greeted with a screen that I have in the show notes just saying Windows 10 Pro, Windows is activated with a digital license. You do have to go to the activation service, but it just moves you along. So you know, you and I have both told our listeners what I wanted to, which is even today, even though they sort of say you need to purchase a license, and last night when I was doing it from a Windows 7 machine, I was following through the download Windows 10, and it took me through this purchase process.
I clicked your link, and for me on this Mac, it did the same page, the proper page without any upsell. So I think it's because you were on Windows 7. Should be a caveat issued here, because nobody, Ed Bott, Paul Thurrott, nobody has been able to verify that this is Microsoft policy. What's not clear, and I just want to say it's not guaranteed to work because Microsoft says it doesn't work. It seems to work with everybody we talk to.
Right.
But here's the reason I say that. If it doesn't work, you're now going to have installed Windows 10 on top of your Windows 7. And there's, you know, that may be a pain in the butt for you. There is a rollback, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you could theoretically roll back.
You are able to back out.
I'd still back it up before you do this. That would be my
And I did also pursue the state of the online dialogue about this. And the only problem that anyone reported was the typical, like, the upgrade hung because of some random, you know, hard drive or the USB. I mean, you know, like, there are various reasons why Windows 10 upgrade just fails. And so when it succeeds...
Microsoft hasn't fixed that part yet.
No. So when it succeeds, you seem to be golden. But as a consequence of the fact that it sometimes fails, all of that rollback stuff is there.
And
so,
you'll be glad if you have an image, too, so just for safety.
Yeah, and that would be a good thing to do, you know, make an image. But I just wanted our listeners to know if they're feeling like, I sure do wish I had gotten it when I could, well, that, you know, I don't think it'll ever not be available.
I did see one post on Reddit from somebody who says he worked in the Windows division, and that this is always, you probably saw it too, this has always been the policy. They don't announce it because they want to make money if they can, because it is a $130 upgrade if you pay for it. But he said it comes from Terry Myerson, who's been gone for about a year from Windows, who really was trying to get the upgrade numbers, the percentage of upgrades high, didn't really care. Windows revenue is no longer that important to Microsoft. It's not fully credible that Microsoft would turn its back on $130 from every upgrader. They're maybe a little bit more nervous about having a lot of Windows 7s out in the wild.
Well, yeah, and remember, we covered it at the time. They were pushing to their shareholders or their stockholders, like, all of the, the monetization opportunities, which would be made possible by all the things in Windows 10 that all of us dislike. So it's like, okay, well, that's all still there. So, yeah.
The other thing that's a question mark is whether you need to install on top of an existing Windows 7 or you can do a clean install. And most of the people I've seen say best to just install on top of.
Yes, I would also do that because it might not know.
Right.
That, I mean, so you have the option. You will be presented with the option of creating installation media or just upgrading the system that you're running on. And for the sake of preserving your and like essentially promoting your Win 7 or Win 8 license to Win 10, I would say just upgrade over. But, yes, make an image first.
Some people have done clean installs and it's worked.
Oh, good.
The other thing I would say that's important for everybody to know is the way activation now works, once Windows 10 is activated on a machine, at that point, you can wipe it, you can do anything you want. You have what Microsoft calls an entitlement to Windows 10. That machine, for thereafter, as long as you don't change major system components, will be activated for Windows 10. So a clean install after the fact is fine.
Yeah, and you know, you and I have always been believers of clean install. I don't think I have. In fact, I am sure I have never once in my life done a major Windows version upgrade. It's like, it's not worth it. Just start over.
If you have a version of 7 installed, go ahead and install on top of it. If you don't, go ahead and try, because people in the chat are saying, no, it works with a clean install too. So this is what's so strange. Microsoft has been dead silent on all this.
Yes.
And who knows, after they hear this show, they may flip off the switch, right?
They say, whoop out that page.
Yeah. But for now, it works. Now, here's the real question, Steve. Should you upgrade to Windows 10?
That is a question. I mean, I'm liking, not immediately, as we know. I mean, I'd still be on XP if my XP machine hadn't just finally fallen off a cliff. It just decided, okay, I'm tired.
But you're a security expert. I wouldn't recommend most people run XP
online, right? No, and I absolutely agree. I've made peace with Win 10. I have it on a bunch of systems. I'm comfortable with it. I have access, thanks to my MSDN subscription, to the long-term servicing channel. So I'm able to install a machine that doesn't have any of the cruft on it. And I have decruftified a number of, you know, standard Win 10 Pro machines. So, you know, to get the Candy Crush Soda Saga and all that other nonsense off of it.
There's a PowerShell one-liner that will delete all of these apps.
Yes.
That's what I always do. Yes. I mean, there, a complaint some people have had, I know you've had, is that you can't really fully turn off the telemetry, the phoning home that Windows does. But, I don't know. If you're going to use Windows, you might as well live with that.
Yeah, and of course, we know that there are some small percentage of people who have real problems with it. But again, it's a small percentage. They're loud. And Paul and Mary Jo cover those sorts of things when they happen.
We hear
and it, unfortunately, it does create reputation damage for Windows 10, because people hear that and they go, I don't want any of that.
Honestly, personally, I think it's as good as Windows 7, which I think was the best version of Windows Microsoft ever made. I think 10 is fine. I'm not a Windows fan, but 10 is no worse than any other Windows, and it's better than most. How about that?
No. Yep, I agree. And the only thing I wish is that this whole rolling Windows forward thing, which continually creates instability, I wish they just, like, let it alone. You know, and I heard Mary Jo saying that last week. They just leave it alone for a year instead of continuing to fuss with it, because
they kind of did this. The most recent update, 1909, was barely a feature update. It was really more just a cumulative update of bugs. And I think that everybody loved that. Everybody said, oh, thank you.
So did you see that they've announced now formally what the next one is going to be? I said to Lori last night, now this is not going to confuse anybody.
No.
Because you're going to have Windows 10 2004. It's like, wait, what?
Huh?
In 2020?
Huh?
We're going to get the 2004 version of Windows 10? What?
Yeah, Paul and Mary Jo don't like it. Yeah.
What are they thinking? Okay, well, speaking of numbers, we are now counting down to 32768, which the programmers among us know is 15 bits in binary. 65536 is the full 16 bits, so half that is 32768. Unfortunately, due to a mistake in the firmware, running a large set of Hewlett-Packard Enterprise-class SSDs, the instant the total power-on running time of any of those SSDs crosses 32,768 hours, 32768, which is 3 years, 270 days and 8 hours, all of those drives will simultaneously become totally and unrecoverably offline, taking all of their stored data with it.
Oh, my God. That's terrible.
it's a catastrophe. So there is HP's customer bulletin. I have a link in the show notes. Says bulletin, HPE SAS solid-state drives, critical firmware upgrade required for certain HPE SAS solid-state drives models to prevent drive failure at 32,768 hours of operation.
That's a really concrete MTBF. They all fail at 32,768. All of them.
Yes. In fact, it even says suggests that if the drives were simultaneously commissioned into a fault-tolerant RAID, they would probably all fail at the same time.
Now, these are enterprise drives, so I'm going to guess they're probably not in the kinds of PCs our listeners are buying, unless they...
Well, we have a lot of high-end listeners.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But so not like in your HP laptop. That's even a different company these days.
Right. Right. So they said, important, this HP D8, that's what you want to get. You want the HP D8 firmware, they said, is considered a critical fix and is required to address the issue detailed below. HPE, that is HP Enterprise, strongly recommends immediate application of this critical fix, neglecting to update to SSD firmware version HPD8 will result in drive failure and data loss at 32,768 hours of operation and require restoration of data from backup in non-fault tolerance, such as RAID 0, and in fault-tolerance RAID mode if more drive fails than what is supported by the fault-tolerance RAID mode logical drive. By disregarding this notification and not performing the recommended resolution, the customer accepts the risk of incurring future-related errors. They said HP was notified by a solid-state drive manufacturer of a firmware defect affecting certain SAS SSD models.
So it wasn't HP software, their supplier.
Yeah, exactly. Used in a number of HP server and storage products. And now here they are. The HPE ProLiant, the Synergy, the Apollo, the D3000, D6000, and D6020 disk enclosures, MSA Storage, Storage Easy, 1000 Storage, Store Virtual 4335 Hybrid Storage, and Store Virtual 3000 Storage are affected. Then they said the following platforms are not affected by this issue. The HPE 3PAR StoreServe Storage, the D8000 disk enclosure, the Nimble Storage, Primera Storage, Store Once Systems, XP Storage, and Simplicity, which is hard to say. Simplicity. Yes, so well named Simplicity. And they finally said the issue affects SSDs with an HP firmware version prior to HPD8 that results in SSD failure. At that time, after the SSD failure occurs, neither the SSD nor the data can be recovered. In other words, it bricks itself. It hard bricks itself at 32K hours. In addition, SSDs, which were put into service at the same time, will likely fail nearly simultaneously. Yikes. So in the disclosure, they list the 20 SSD model numbers. So anyone who's listening who worries they may be affected, I would take this seriously. And they do have a firmware update software for Linux, Windows, VMware, ESXi provided from a links at that. So, wow. And, you know, it's not clear that everybody who has these is, like, on the mailing list and is going to get, you know, see this announcement. So I do hope that this information gets picked up and covered enough that people aren't going to be hurt.
All our shows from now, you know, through the rest of the week.
Yeah.
These people need to hear it, yeah.
It's belly up.
No matter what we do, though, there's going to be people lose data. It's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. If, for example, how much, as we know, how many Bluekeep vulnerable RDP servers are currently exposed? Well, we know it's about 500,000,
right,
despite the fact that, you know, the news couldn't have been any more well covered than it has been.
Can you believe there are people who don't listen to security now?
Doesn't matter.
What's wrong with them?
Apparently fewer every day, Leo, so that's good.
We're going to take over the world at this rate in the year 32,768.
And, yeah, wow. So it turns out the EU is not happy about a possible U.S. encryption ban. And when I read that headline, I thought, wait, what possible U.S. encryption ban? Well, okay, so it's nothing that our listeners haven't heard about. Although it turns out that the ongoing battle over end-to-end encryption took a bit of a turn last week when EU officials warned that they may not take kindly to a U.S. encryption ban or the insertion of a crypto backdoor in the U.S.-based technologies. And again, as I said, 2020... it really does promise to be an interesting year. Back in June of this year, it turns out that there was a little publicized meeting where senior U.S. government officials quietly met to discuss whether they could legislate tech companies into not using unbreakable encryption.
Whoa, I don't remember that.
It was not covered. There was apparently a story in Politico that covered the NSC, the National Security Council.
Oh, I do remember that, but I just dismissed it as political posturing. I do remember this story, yeah.
Right, and because they were wondering whether to ask Congress to outlaw outlaw end-to-end encryption. So, of course, let's just punt this one. So U.S. officials did not reach a decision one way or the other on the issue. But news of the conversation spooked some enough to ask the EU some formal questions, which were picked up by somebody at TechDirt, Glenn Moody at TechDirt. The person asking the EU was someone named Corner, who asked whether the Commission would consider a similar ban on encryption in the EU. He also asked what a U.S. ban would mean for existing data exchange agreements between the EU and the U.S. And it turns out that that actually does affect our various treaties. So the question was posed, would a ban on encryption in the USA render data transfers to the U.S. illegal in light of the requirement of the EU GDPR for built-in data protection? At the moment, our two regions, the EU and the U.S., enjoy an agreement known as the EU-U.S. Privacy Shield, which they introduced after the European Court of Justice invalidated a previous agreement, which was called the International Safe Harbor Privacy Principles. So today's Privacy Shield, which is what we have now, is a voluntary certification scheme for U.S. businesses. By certifying under the scheme, U.S. companies prove their adequacy to transfer and process data on on EU citizens. It shows that the companies have made some effort to follow Europe's strict privacy principles in the absence of any cohesive federal privacy law in the U.S. So it's sort of a stopgap, you know, let's keep doing things while we figure out what direction the U.S. is going to take. On November 20th, just a couple weeks ago, European Commission officials replied with their answers, confirming that they would not consider a ban on encryption in the region and pointing out that the General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR, explicitly refers to encryption as a privacy protection measure. But the answer to the next question was a bit more contentious. They said, if the U.S. were to enact new legislation in this area, the commission would carefully assess its impact on the adequacy finding for the EU-US privacy shield, which, as we just said, is that framework which the Commission has found to provide a level of data protection that's essentially equivalent to the level of protection in the EU, thus allowing for the transfer of personal data from the EU to participating companies in the US without any further restrictions. So the jury's still out on how the EU would react to cross-Atlantic data transfers if the U.S. were to implement crypto backdoors, which, you know, it seems unlikely that end-to-end encryption itself would be outlawed, but, you know, we keep having U.S. law enforcement being unhappy about the going dark problem and their inability to serve a warrant, at least, which would compel the decryption of specific conversations. So there's an attorney, Ashley Winton, who is a UK-based specialist in privacy law, who explained that a split between the two territories on data exchange could have serious consequences. He said, "We know that under the GDPR, personal data must be held securely. So legislating against strong encryption or introducing legal backdoors is not going to be good for the safe passage of European personal data, howsoever it gets to the U.S. Unlike the annual privacy shield, in theory, if the European Court were to determine that the transfer of personal data to the U.S. was no longer safe, all affected transfers could be halted immediately. Well, you know, that's not going to happen, but it's apparently going to cause some sort of kerfuffle. So anyway, I just thought this was interesting that, you know, we're sort of sitting here worrying about what the U.S. is going to do and what's going to happen with our technology. It hadn't really occurred to me that Europe is looking at the strength of their GDPR and essentially requiring that to the degree that U.S. companies end up with EU citizen data, our U.S. companies need to be offering a similar level of protection. And it may well be that law enforcement requiring the ability, depending upon the way it's implemented, I mean, again, backdoor, as we know, is a heavily freighted term, but you know, it may cause some ruffling of treaties between the U.S. and the rest of Europe. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops. And Leah, let's take our second break, and then we're going to talk about this interesting thing that happened in Washington, where the government, agencies of the government, are being encouraged to allow themselves to be hacked.
Okay. Yeah, I remember when the NSC considered it, and I think we may have reported on it, but given that by the time the story came out in Politico, they'd already declined to do it, and given the composition of the NSC at the time, I didn't judge it to be a serious interest in doing this. And you could see why, you know, somebody might have said, what if we did this? And then somebody maybe more astute said, if we do that, we can't do business with the EU anymore. Might have just killed it, right? I mean, I don't know how strong the interest is or was in doing it. I hope it wasn't strong. And we know that
it hasn't gone away.
No,
it hasn't gone away.
Yeah, and the FBI director asked for it, and a number of people have asked for it. Let's just hope saner heads prevail.
As people say, well, you may ask.
You can ask. I think also the fact that the EU said this might have been also a little bit of a, hey, guys, over here, if you do that, just be ready because it's going to cause some waves. That may be the whole point of the EU saying this, right?
Right.
Just a
little
reminder that it's
not all about you guys.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not all about you. You Yanks.
Yeah. I think that's probably what's going on there. Just in case. anybody thought this was a good idea. Back to Steve Areno.
So, under the heading of "This should be interesting," the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency, CISA, which, you know, we run across that acronym from time to time. They're active in doing things. It's part of the Department of Homeland Security. They've just published what they call the VDP, the Vulnerability Directive Policy, requiring executive branch federal agencies to be welcoming and responsive to cybersecurity bug reports from the general public. I have a link in the show notes to the CISA.gov page, and they said a VDP directive and you. They said, today we're issuing a draft binding operational directive, BOD 20-01, which will require federal civilian executive branch agencies to publish a vulnerability disclosure policy. A VDP allows people who have seen something to say something to those who can fix it. It makes clear that an agency welcomes and authorizes good faith security research on specific internet accessible systems. In preparing this directive, we worked with several agencies that have VDPs and made an effort to align the directive with federal guidance, international standards, and good practices. But this directive is slightly different from others we've issued, where agencies are directed to take an action and then CISA verifies the action has taken place. Here, while agencies must maintain VDPs that are the beneficiaries of vulnerability reports, it's the public that will provide those reports and will be the true beneficiaries of vulnerability remediation. That's why we're doing something we've never done before with our directives, seeking public feedback before issuance. We want to hear from people with personal or institutional expertise in vulnerability disclosure. We also want to hear from organizations that have a VDP and manage coordinated vulnerability disclosures. In seeking public comment, we're also nodding to the fact that, to our knowledge, a requirement for individual enterprises to maintain a vulnerability disclosure policy has never been done before, and certainly not on this scale. So what does the draft directive do? It lights a fire. Each agency must publish a VDP and maintain handling procedures, and the directive outlines a set of required elements for both. It draws a line in the sand. Systems born after publication of a VDP must be included in scope of an agency's VDP. It expands the circle until everything is included. At least one new system or service must be added every 90 days to the scope of an agency's VDP. It starts the clock. There's an upper bound 2 years from issuance in this draft for when all internet accessible systems must be within scope. All are welcome. Anyone that finds a problem must be able to report it to an agency. No catch and keep. An agency may only request a reasonably time-limited restriction against outside disclosure to comply with their VDP, and defense, not offense. Submissions are for defensive purposes. They don't go to the vulnerability equities process. And then they add 2 points for what it doesn't do. It does not establish a federal bug bounty. A bug bounty is a program that pays researchers, as we know, for valid and impactful findings. Nothing in this directive prevents individual agencies from establishing a bug bounty of their own, though, and does not create a national VDP. The directive is an executive branch policy instruction that requires federal civilian executive branch agencies to have a VDP. The difference might appear slight, but they're very different things. And then it says, so why isn't this a national VDP? We think a single universal vulnerability disclosure policy for the executive branch is a good goal. it makes sense, particularly when each agency has all internet accessible systems in scope. But we expect that goal to be an unrealistic starting place for most agencies. Instead, the directive supports a phase-based approach to widening scope over time, allowing each enterprise, comprised of the humans and their organizational tools, norms, and culture, to level up incrementally. Then they finish with doing good things together. We believe that if you make good things easier to do, more people will do them. With this directive, we want to take steps that diminish complexity and make expectations plain. In support of that, we're also sharing draft implementation guidance on the directive, as well as a draft VDP template. They said, we welcome your feedback and perspective on all these documents, as well as any comments on our approach. Public comment will take place on GitHub and last until December 27th, so basically for 1 month. I've got links to the details in the show notes, and I think this represents a welcome and really, you know, forward-looking, an insightful step forward for the U.S. government. I'm surprised, but I'm really pleased to see it. You know, basically encouraging, explicitly encouraging the publication of formal guidance for people who find problems with government systems. You know, you're not risking, probably, given that you provide the information to the relative agency in a responsible fashion. You know, you're not going to have the feds knocking on your door, hauling you away to jail, given that you disclose responsibly. So, and the idea that it's going to be requiring on a, you know, every 90 days, something else needs to be put in scope, and regardless, everything must be within scope in 2 years. It means that 2 years from now, everything that this VDP policy covers will be subject to scrutiny from the outside world, and the nature of responsible disclosure explicitly laid out. So, bravo to, surprisingly so.
I also want to say bravo to Jeanette Manfra, who I don't know who that is. She wrote the memo. It is the best written bureaucratic memo I've ever. I mean, it has pineapple pizza in it. It's,
yes.
She is a good writer.
I agree with you. I have. Yep.
Yeah. She's assistant. Yep. She's not, some flack hired to write these either. She's the assistant director for cybersecurity for the Department of Homeland Security. So she is a fairly high up bureaucrat, but man, can she write?
I agree. I thought it was really well written.
Oh, she's a former communications specialist and military intelligence officer. Wow. They're doing something right there, I tell you.
Yeah, nice.
I have to get her on one of our shows. You think she'd be able to talk about stuff? This is really interesting.
Oh, like without being bound by like crippling non-disclosures.
Yeah. She says at CISA, we work to do good things. Some are easy, like eating pineapple on pizza. And she has a link, by the way. Some are hard, like managing risks in 5G. Yet we know if it's hard to do good things, most people won't do them. And reporting a vulnerability on the government system shouldn't be so hard.
Yes.
It's really well written. Anyway, sorry, I threw that in because I...
No, I'm glad you did, because
you
that, that helps
see
you.
That.
Yes.
By the way, the pineapple pizza takes you to an article on understanding foreign interference, the war on pineapple.
Okay.
This is interesting. Targeting divisive issues like pineapple on pizza. Moving accounts into place. This is actually a really good slideshow on how foreign interference works. Pineapple pizza controversy rocks the U.S.
Oh, right. Fake news.
Fake news.
Yep.
Wow. I'm impressed. Wow. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to derail.
No, I'm glad. I'm glad for that.
Deserve some credit.
So as our listeners know, last summer was the summer and like sort of before the school year, the summer where I had a hard time. I think ransomware was the overwhelming topic of the podcast for 3 or 4 weeks running because there was just so much of it happening. And I promised I wouldn't, you know, do that anymore. But sometimes something that's particularly egregious happens. And so it's necessary to just take a moment and mention it. In this instance, we have this is like the big win, unfortunately, for ransomware guys is when, and we've talked about this also, the managed service provider, the idea that there is a single organization that is providing managed services to some large network of their customers and clients. And something happens that at the managed service provider to let bad guys get in, they then set up shop, they figure out like where they are, and they say, holy crap, look what we have access to. And then they, of course, are able to essentially create a devastating attack. In this case, this is a healthcare managed service provider that was responsible for providing services for 110 nursing homes. So think about that, 110, and also some acute care facilities. All of them have been simultaneously crippled by a ransomware attack on that on their common IT provider, whose name is Virtual Care Provider Inc., VCPI. They're a Wisconsin-based managed care provider. They provide data management and records hosting, security, and access management to nursing homes across the U.S. Brian Krebs picked up on this last Monday while the attack was still underway. He said that it involves our old friend Ryuk, and as we know, the hackers who are driving Ryuk are known to calculate how much ransom they feel the victimized organizations can be forced to pay based on the size and perceived value of the destruction that they have wrought. But we've also seen instances where the crooks get it wrong, and that appears to be the case here. VCPI's chief executive and owner, Karen Christensen, told Brian that her company simply cannot afford to pay the $14 million Bitcoin ransom. I mean, you know, this is, you know, yes, they're a managed care provider for 114 healthcare facilities, but, you know, it's a competitive industry. They don't have $14 million and apparently no insurance. She said they can't begin to pay the $14 million ransom. As it is, it turns out, VCPI's own employees have been asking when they'll get paid.
Wow.
Because it's their own salary infrastructure was also hit. But she said the top priority is to wrestle back access to the lost electronic medical records. The attack successfully affected all of the firm's core offerings: internet service, email, access to patient records, client billing, and phone systems, and even the internet payroll operations that VCPI uses to pay its own workforce of nearly 150 employees. Regaining access to electronic health records is the top priority because without that access, the lives of the seniors and others who reside in critical care facilities are at stake. Christensen said to Brian, "We have some facilities where the nurses can't get the drugs updated and the order put in so the drugs can arrive on time. In another example, we have an assisted living facility that is just a single unit that connects to billing. If they don't get their billing into Medicaid by December 5th, that's 2 days from now, they close their doors. It's over. And seniors who have no family to go to are then suddenly homeless." Karen said.
These people, these ransomware guys are jerks.
I know. They said, we have many clients right now who are demanding, just give us our data, she said. But we can't. We don't have it. So imagine how devastated she must be. A report from Vanderbilt University's Owen Graduate School of Management noted that the corrective actions being taken to harden and secure facilities and systems can, at least temporarily, worsen the problem. You know, they wrote, corrective actions are intended to remedy the deficiencies in privacy and security of protected health information. However, enhanced security measures may introduce usability, which they said we define as the ease of use problems. New security procedures typically alter how clinicians access and use clinical information and health information systems and may disrupt the provision of care as providers require additional time to learn and to use the new and modified systems. In other words, yeah, additional layers of security can be annoying, but of course they can prevent this. But anyway, the group behind Ryuk are serious. In another similar attack, there were hundreds of veterinary hospitals were similarly affected. So, you know, I just wanted to point out that these sorts of cyber attacks that are of this nature, I mean, are having devastating effect in the real world. And as you said, Leo, you know, these guys are just real creeps.
They're also stupid because they're asking for more than the company can pay. They're never going to get money. So,
right.
It
exactly.
Probably is a 14-year-old. I mean, with no real life experience. I mean, that's too bad. That's the problem with real is you can script kiddie can do it now. Anybody can do it.
Yeah, exactly. Brian reported that the attack was unleashed inside VCPI's networks around 1 p.m. Central Time on the 17th of November. So it's been happening for some time. It could have been lying in wait for a while as the intruders mapped out the internal networks and compromised the resources and data backup systems in preparation for the ultimate attack. Because, of course, you know, they want to nuke the backups also, and if they have any opportunity to do that, because that renders the victims utterly helpless. And so apparently, these people, you know, were acting as responsibly as they could, but the bad guys were in there long enough to be able to find and compromise their backup systems as well. So, you know, we just can't say, well, yeah, you deserved it because you weren't doing the right thing. And this takes me back to the point I've been making about any of our listeners who may be in enterprises using managed services. What tends to happen is that the managed service provider just says, well, you know, give us remote desktop access into your network. We talked about last week how most managed service providers have admin level access into the networks of the clients that they're providing services to. Well, yeah, that means if something gets into the managed service provider, they have admin access into, you know, the networks of their clients. You don't want that to be you. Generally, that level of access isn't needed. So, everyone wants it because it's easy. In the same way that we used to all just want to run as admin because, oh, look, I can do anything I want to without having to switch users. And we've learned the lesson of how that's not safe. So, boy, be really careful. It's not just your own network that you need to be careful about. You really need, essentially, as IT, you're indirectly taking responsibility for the security of anybody who you let in. And managed service providers are getting knocked over. So I just wanted to drive that point home again. Whew. Firefox is seriously pushing back on tracking signal leakage. As we know, cookies are not only the most obvious, sanctioned, and most easily controllable aspect of web browser based internet tracking, they are what people use by default. But as we've talked about, fingerprinting makes use of many subtle signals that browsers may send in an attempt to lock onto a user who's deliberately attempting to thwart cookie-based tracking. And as it turned out, when I was putting this together last night, I realized, oh, yeah, me too. I was sitting in front of a very wide screen. It's 3840 by 1600 screen. And so it's impractically, I think it's probably the one that Lisa has, Leo, because I know you have mentioned that I've heard you say that Lisa has a really
wide. Oh, it's so
wide...
amazing. Every time I see it, I say, I want this.
And so, you know, you don't run a browser full screen on a screen that wide.
Right.
You know, it doesn't need it. No. You know, it's ridiculous. No. So I realized that I had the browser that I was using as I was pulling the show together last evening. It was on some random arbitrary slice of the screen, meaning that its x-coordinate and its horizontal width were random. They weren't random numbers, but they were just some, you know, they were not standard numbers. It wasn't x of 0 and width of 1600, which is like, you know, standard resolutions. I was at some particular, you know, 1326x and 1842 in width, which is something that script running in my browser, that is script running in an ad, is able to see, which means so long as I don't move my window around, and generally when I relaunch my browser, it comes back where I last used it. So that tends to be kind of a generally sticky little bit of beacon information that I'm sending out as I move around the web. And there are, you know, as we know, all kinds of similar soft signals which, when they're merged together, can serve to profile us, you know, like things like what time zone we're in, the exact pixel layout of our browser, which fonts we have installed in our system. And, you know, so just deleting cookies no longer tells the whole story. We talked, in fact, about how there was a navigator.getBattery function, which was allowing advertising scripts to determine the exact battery charge of the machines their users were using, and note that it tends to change predictably over time. I mean, it's, you know, we tend to think, oh my Lord, nobody is going to go to the trouble of like monitoring that. It turns out people are. So anyway, that's the backdrop against which Firefox has been very vocal about introducing explicit anti-fingerprinting code into the base browser. It's there now, but it is not turned on by default. There, and we've talked about various of these things over time. Like, it's even possible for an ad to draw something in, like draw something with vector art, and then snap the pixels that result and look at subtle variations in the way lines are drawn and rendered into digital pixels. Turns out those things vary subtly from OS to OS and from version, even version of operating system, and browser to browser. So there's that. Absolute screen coordinations coordinates would be obscured. The image extraction would be blocked. They're considering rounding window dimensions to multiples of 200 and by 100. Only specific system fonts would be enumerated. The time precision would be reduced to 100 milliseconds, and 100 milliseconds of deliberate jitter would be added. The keyboard layout would be spoofed. The locale would be spoofed to simply English and U.S. the date input field and the date picker panels would be spoofed. I mean, there's like clearly the bad guys have gone to so much effort in order to pick up on signals. The time zone that we're in would not be accurate. It would be spoofed to UTC so that everything would be uniform, and all device sensors would be disabled. Turns out, you know, you can read things like position of the device that the user is holding. So, of course, the downside to all of this is that any websites that were making legitimate and beneficial use of those details, like, you know, we talked about how could you use battery level? Well, maybe if you were a particularly conscientious gaming app, you might back off on the amount of high energy GPU usage if you saw that a laptop's battery was getting lower. Or you might, you know, proactively say to the user, hey, you better save your game. Looks like things are getting dangerously close to low. So there are, you know, useful things this can be done for, or useful applications for these things. But unfortunately, it turns out the actual users of these, as instrumentation has shown, are the bad guys rather than the good guys. So despite the fact that all of these features have been added to our browsers over time, they're being used against us more than for us. So the good news is, as we know, there's a tyranny of the default. Most users are running Firefox just out of the box. Our listeners probably already have fingerprinting turned on. I know I do. The good news is we're now at version 70, two major versions from now, at Firefox 72. If everything continues to go smoothly, that fingerprinting default will be switched to on. So as Firefox is updated across the board to version 72, this kind of long-term fingerprint tracking will, at least for Firefox users, become increasingly difficult and, you know, arguably soft to a point that it no longer provides sufficient precision for the bad guys to even bother with it, which will be a nice thing. And our last little bit of news for the week, as you noted on the Sunday show, Leo, it was a slow news week because the hackers, in our case, took Thanksgiving off. But there was one more piece of news that I thought was interesting, which is new problems with Windows DLLs, or I guess I should say continuing problems with Windows DLLs. As we know, some ideas in computer science are fundamentally fraught with problems. An example would be the oh-so-convenient, though horrifically insecure practice of allocating temporary communications buffers on a stack that is shared with code execution, history, and pointers. What could possibly go wrong? Another historically bad idea has been Windows dynamically linked libraries. We know that Windows designers had their hearts in the right place. Back in the 1980s, when Windows was attempting to run in a system that had a 10 megabyte hard drive, actually, I guess the early Windows ran off of floppies, and 512K bytes of RAM, there was not a single byte to waste. So there was tremendous pressure to share any common functional code among the system's components and applications. The idea of the DLL was clever in that not only could there only need to be one DLL stored on the hard drive, but even more importantly, only one copy would ever be physically loaded into physical memory. When another program was run and wished to use some of the functions from one of the shareable DLLs, the image of an already loaded instance of that DLL would be mapped into the virtual memory space of the requesting app by the Windows loader. So that there weren't, you know, even apps that needed the same things would not be causing a second copy to occupy RAM. This allowed much more to be accomplished with a small disk and a small RAM footprint. But this technology did not age well. Over time, there was a divergence of DLL versions and capabilities. DLLs could use other DLLs, and that created a confusing network of inter-DLL dependencies. Such a mess arose that Microsoft was finally forced to step in and attempt to fix this problem. Quoting from the Wikipedia entry on what's known as side-by-side assembly, Wikipedia says, side-by-side assembly, SXS or WinSXS on Microsoft Windows technology, is a standard for executable files in Windows 98 second edition. All the way back then, Windows 2000 and later versions of Windows, that attempts to alleviate problems, collectively known as DLL hell, that arise from the use of dynamic link libraries in Microsoft Windows. Such problems, Wikipedia writes, include version conflicts, missing DLLs, duplicate DLLs, and incorrect or missing registration. In side-by-side, Windows stores multiple versions of a DLL in the WinSXS subdirectory of the Windows directory and loads them on demand. This reduces dependency problems for applications that include a side-by-side manifest. They said Microsoft Visual C++ 2005 and 2008 employ side-by-side with all C runtime libraries. However, runtime libraries in Visual C++ 2010 no longer use this technology. Instead, they include the version number of a DLL in its file name, which means that different versions of one DLL will technically be completely different DLLs now. I mean, this has just been a disaster. So, as I said, Microsoft designers were doing what they needed to at the time. And if anything, with the unfair benefit of 2020 hindsight, Microsoft might now be criticized for not completely killing off DLLs a long time ago. But one thing that Microsoft has always provided has been rigorous backward compatibility, and, you know, pretty much at any cost. And boy, trying to corral and manage what has happened with DLLs is the price that they're now paying. So this brings us to today, or rather yesterday, when researchers with Safe Breach Labs published a trio of security advisories which described DLL-related bugs occurring in Autodesk, Trend Micro, and Kaspersky software. All of the problems were responsibly disclosed to their respective software publishers before their public disclosure, which was made yesterday. And interestingly, all of these problems still relate to the original way that DLLs work. We've talked about some security problems in the past where, for example, if an app references a DLL, the Windows loader looks around the system for the DLL. Typically, it looks first in the app's own directory, which, thank goodness, allows apps to bring a copy of the DLL with them. One of the many problems which DLLs have had has been newer apps would overwrite the DLLs with the same name but a different version number, and that DLL would act in some different fashion, which would cause – remember those days, Leo, where you install like – some new software on Windows, and suddenly something that used to work before would break.
The worst offender was the C++ libraries. And if you look in your Windows install, even today, you probably have multiple C++ DLLs from a different variety of versions, and it can really screw with you. It is DLL hell.
Yeah, it's been a complete collapse of that model.
The idea is great. These are dynamic linked libraries. The idea is the application doesn't have to have everything in the application. You can link the libraries. but somehow it just got out of control.
Just, yeah. Even when Windows 98 second edition was already beginning to like do some sequestering of DLLs, because it was like, now we have lots of memory, we've got lots of drive space, we just wish everyone would bring their own code with them and not rely on anybody else.
Or because, Microsoft should standardize on a single C++ runtime and deprecate all the rest, and if you try to install an older one, I don't know, seems like it's Microsoft's fault somewhat, but maybe not.
Yeah,
maybe
not. No, I agree. It was a good idea, but really, Apple has a reputation for killing things.
Yeah, this doesn't happen on Apple's. Yeah.
Right. But the flip side is Apple does get criticism for like killing off things like saying, okay, we're no longer going to support such and such.
Also, Apple, if you look at it, the way you package apps on Apple, that monolithic icon hides a huge number of stuff, including all the libraries. They keep it all in the library in the icon. And so they're very large apps. I just downloaded an app that was half a gigabyte, and that didn't do anything. You know, because honestly, otherwise you'd have 18 copies of Electron in all different system folders. Instead, you have 18 copies of Electron, but they're all within the package icon. So maybe I don't know if it's better, but it at least eliminates DLL hell.
Well, so one of the things that Windows did, because the concept was an app didn't have to have its own DLLs, it would be able to use them if they were in the system.
Right.
So that allowed the Windows loader to go looking around for them. And that's been a cause of problems in the past. Turns out, believe it or not, even now, that hasn't gone away. So in the case of Trend Micro Maximum Security, versions below version 16.0.1221, there's a vulnerability that just got fixed. The researchers found that the service known as CoreServiceShell.exe, it loads a DLL, PA CoreProductAdapter.dll. However, in the case of a missing DLL, the lack of safe DLL loading and the lack of DLL signature validation, hackers are able to exploit this as a security hole to cause their own unsigned malicious replacement DLLs to be loaded by the Trend Micro Maximum Security service every time that service runs. And the service runs with the NT authority / system permission, which is the highest permission set of permissions in the system. Basically, it's like kernel, you know, root level permission. So it turns out that it is extremely easy to evade all the other provisions that Trend Micro put into place in order to prevent their system from being hacked, because they weren't checking the signature of the DLL that they were loading. Windows would just go find a DLL of the proper name, and all the bad guys have to do is arrange to get that DLL in the Windows search path upstream of where Trend Micro put the real one, and that would cause a persistent, highly privileged load of a malicious DLL. So there, as I said, this whole DLL thing, not only do things not work, but it has been a serious security problem moving forward. The second vulnerability in Kaspersky Secure Connection is a VPN client, part of Kaspersky's Internet Security Solutions, which is used, the VPN is used to create a secure connection back to the vendor's servers for transferring updates and information. Like Trend Micro, their VPN versions below 4 does not check the signatures of the DLL it loads. And it also runs that DLL with maximum system permissions. And because it's a DLL, it's possible for the bad guys to drop a malicious one elsewhere in the system, in the Windows DLL search path, which Kaspersky will cause to have loaded and executed preferentially to their own, thanks to Windows. And Autodesk, not very much different. In this case, all of these things are loading with the NT Authority system permission, and Autodesk was found not to be checking the signature of its DLLs. The researchers wrote, after an attacker gains access to a computer, they might have privileges limited to them to access only certain files and data, but the Autodesk service provides them with the ability to operate as NT Authority System, which is the most powerful user in Windows. So they can then access almost every file and process which belongs to the user on the computer. So, you know, what we've seen is that the DLL design pattern and methodology is so deeply ingrained into Windows that there really is nothing Microsoft can do about it today. The fact that Windows side-by-side mess doesn't directly address DLL security. It only is there so that modern Windows have any chance of running at all these days. I was initially a bit surprised to learn that processes running with maximum permission were allowed to have unsigned DLLs loaded into their process space. But upon reflection, changing that at this point would also break too many long-standing assumptions. So I suppose the best we can do is to keep patching and be glad that there are folks like Safe Breach Labs, these guys, who take it upon themselves to find and responsibly disclose those problems when they are found. And I wanted to take a moment just to sort of touch base on the Joy of Sync solutions that I found. It occurred to me because I stumbled upon some of the notes that I had made, and I realized that in all the time that I have been using it, I have never once had a problem. It has never once failed me. It is essentially the reason I went looking for something else when I was having problems with Dropbox's sync. So I don't know what the magic, the magic potion is, the magic programming dust that sync.com has, but they have it. And so I just, it's as we know, it's often the case that we'll start to use something and then something will happen and it will go, oh, well, and stop using it and fail to let everybody know that our recommendation changed. So I just wanted to remind people about it. They make 5 gig free for anyone who is interested. I have a link in the show notes, which will give you an extra gig free if you want to give it a try. So you start off with 6 gigs free. It's just grc.sc/sync. And if you use that link, it expands to a link which actually both of us, you and I, get a gig free. I already have 3 terabytes, so I'm fine. But I figured, hey, a difference between 5 and 6 gigs, that's more significant. So anyway, I am every bit as happy and bullish with sync.com as I was. I think I did the Joy of Sync podcast before I left for my tour. Because I think I told you, Leo, that I had forgotten to put the presentation on my laptop. And it was like, oh crap. But then I realized we were literally on the tarmac, and I said to Lori, I said, I think I forgot to put the presentation on the laptop. And she looked at me with alarm, and I said, but it's okay, because I do all of my work now underneath my sync folder, and so I knew that I would be able to get it wherever I was. So anyway, grc.sc, that's, for shortcut, grc.sc/sync. Again, my recommendation stands. I think these guys have nailed it. And I'm also for other applications where I want to do my own peer-to-peer sync thing, I have been using it also extensively for other purposes where it doesn't make sense to me, or there's no need to sync to the cloud, and sync thing has never let me down. And I have it running on my Drobos. It's keeping my two Drobos in sync as well. So anyway, I just wanted to touch base.
You mentioned that SyncDuck. I wanted to use SyncDuck.com because it's end-to-end encrypted, which is awesome.
Yes. But yes, in fact.
Go ahead. Well, they don't have a Linux client.
Yes. Yes, that is the one problem. They don't have Linux. They understood after we talked about it on the podcast, and a lot of our listeners said, hey, thanks, but, would love to use it, but without Linux. And so anyway, they did receive that message.
I hope they made one. I, because of that, ended up using PSync, or pCloud, rather, which is not end-to-end encrypted, but they have a end-to-end encrypted folder. They do have, so you can say, this is this folder I want always end-to-end encrypted,
right.
Which I, for my purposes, was actually sufficient. I'm not too worried about it. They also had, I like this, a lifetime price. I think it was like $200, and that's it for 2 terabytes. So I just bought the 2 terabytes for life, and I just use it as, in some ways, I'm wondering if people really need NAS as much anymore. If as storage gets cheaper, keeping
I agree.
The cloud, it's a, for me, it ends up being much more convenient than my Synology NAS. I just keep everything. I still run Synology NAS, so I have a local backup. But, I think it's a pretty nice solution.
Well, and remember that at least the sync.com also has full versioning. I could you can
right.
go back to
as
any
this,
prior.
As pCloud, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And Dropbox
go back to
does
any...
that now, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love that, because if you screw up, you can go back in time. I'm actually pretty happy with pCloud, and they do have a Linux client, and that's, for me, half of my computing's on Linux, so I kind of have to have that.
So I found the reference. The group that, yes, Promon, who we'll be talking about, calls this vulnerability Strandhog, which is Old Norse, referring to the Viking tactic of raiding coastal areas to plunder and hold people for ransom.
Oh, that's the Strand, probably. That's the
so
strand.
I guess they weren't. I guess those Vikings weren't all just glamorous.
Oh, it wasn't all mead and beards. Viking horns. No, no.
So these guys, Promon security researchers, have found proof of a dangerous Android vulnerability, which, as we know, they call Strandhog or Strandhog, that allows real-life malware to pose as legitimate apps with users unaware they're being targeted. They are a partner with the security firm Lookout, whom we've talked about several times. Lookout confirmed that they've identified 36 malicious apps exploiting the vulnerability. And among them were variants of the BankBot banking Trojan, which was first seen in 2017. During testing, Promon researchers found that all of the 500 most popular Android apps, as ranked by the app intelligence company 42 Matters, are vulnerable to Strandhog. All versions of Android are affected, including Android 10.
Is this
and
their
BankBot.
Logo, or did you make
yes,
that up?
Yes, no, that's their logo. In fact, there's one on their page that has that mask on top of one of the Android bots.
Oh,
there's like there's two Android bots on either side, and then that one in the middle is the evil Android bot. Anyway, BankBot, that's the malware that is being used, is one of the most widespread banking Trojans around, with a ton of variants and new ones appearing continually. BankBot attacks have been detected around the world. In the U.S., Latin America, Europe, and Asia-Pacific region, Strandhog was first detected when banks reported that their customers were reporting missing funds from their accounts. So in their little top-of-the-page summary, they summarize what's the impact of their finding. All versions of Android are affected, including Android 10. All top 500 most popular Android apps can be abused. Real-life malware is exploiting the vulnerability. That is, this is in the wild doing this now to people. 36 malicious apps exploiting the vulnerability have been identified. Oh, boy.
Bless you.
Excuse me. Yeah, I don't think I've ever sneezed before. I've come close a couple times, but there it is. The vulnerability can be exploited without root access. So all it takes to do this is to get a piece of malicious software into an Android device. And unfortunately, Google is always removing malicious code from the Google Play Store. When this is exploited by hackers, they can listen to the user through the microphone. They can take photos through the camera. They can send and receive SMS messages, make and or record phone conversations, phish login credentials, get access to all private photos and files on the device, get location and GPS information, get access to the contacts list, access the user's phone logs. I mean, it's like they were somehow able to root your device, but it turns out that's not necessary. So, what's going on here? How does this happen? It turns out it's through harvesting of dangerous permissions. And I have a graphic from their report in the show notes. They show the user clicking an app icon of a legitimate app in order to launch it. But instead of seeing the legitimate app, the malware is displayed and impersonating the app, which then asks for any permission while pretending to be the legitimate app, like allow to send and view SMS messages, which, depending upon the app, might be something, a permission you would expect to give the app. But unfortunately, as a consequence of leveraging this, and here's the key, designed-in aspect of Android, you're actually giving the permission to the malware, not to the legitimate app, which is then allowed to run and take advantage of the victim. So the vulnerability makes it possible for a malicious app to ask for permissions while pretending to be the legitimate app. And an attacker can ask for any permissions they want: SMS, photos, microphone, GPS, text messages, view photos, eavesdrop, track the victim's movements, whatever. The attack can be designed to request permissions which would be natural for different targeted apps to request to reduce the suspicion on the part of the victims, right? So that would be natural in a little bit of a social engineering hack. Users are unaware that they're giving permission to the hacker and not the authentic app they believe they're using. But wait, there's more. Powerful credential-stealing apps are also enabled by the presentation of faked login prompts. You click on an app where you are expecting to need to log in. A malicious login page is displayed on the victim's screen instead of the legitimate app. Then those credentials are supplied to the actual app in order to log in. Basically, it's a man-in-the-middle attack on your device.
Is this the screen overwrite permissions that we've talked about before?
Yes, it is. It is an extension of those long-standing screen overwrite permissions.
It's always been a problem, but Google seems loath to take them out. I think because apps like Facebook use it for their Messenger pop-up bubbles and things like
that. That's exactly right. So what's going on? What makes StrandHog unique is that it enables these sophisticated attacks without the need for a device to be rooted. It leverages what are arguably weaknesses inherent in Android's multitasking system to enable powerful attacks that allow malicious apps to masquerade as any other app on the device. The exploit uses an Android feature called Task Affinity, which allows any app, including malicious ones, to freely assume any identity within the multitasking system they desire. And as I mentioned at the top, Promon's research found that all of the top 500 most popular Android apps are vulnerable to this attack across every version of Android. What's interesting here is that their research significantly expands upon research which was carried out by Penn State University and the guys at FireEye in 2015. Back then, the researchers theoretically described certain aspects of the vulnerability. At the time, Google dismissed the vulnerability's severity. But ProMon now has clear evidence that hackers are exploiting Strandhog to gain access to devices and apps. The specific malware sample that ProMon analyzed did not reside on Google Play, but it was installed through several dropper apps and hostile downloaders distributed on Google Play. These apps have since been removed, but in spite of Google Play's Protect security suite, dropper apps continue to be published and frequently slip under the radar, with some being downloaded millions of times before being spotted and deleted. And just due to the nature of the way Google Play works, Google is necessarily reactive. Of course, they will remove anything that they become aware of, but this means that some people are downloading and being hurt by malicious apps in the interim. For example, there was one Cam Scanner, which was a PDF creator that contained a malicious module. It had been downloaded 100 million times before Google realized that it was malicious and pulled it. So ProMon's CTO, their chief technology officer, Tom Leismos Hansen, he commented, "We have tangible proof that attackers are exploiting Strandhog in order to steal confidential information. The potential impact of this could be unprecedented in terms of scale and the amount of damage caused, because most apps are vulnerable by default and all Android versions are affected." So I wanted to dig a little bit deeper into this. I was curious about what are the details. So I went back and I found the original security research, which was presented at the 2015 USENIX Security Symposium back in August of 2015. The researchers titled their paper "Towards Discovering and Understanding Task Hijacking in Android." And in their abstract, they wrote, "Android multitasking provides rich features to enhance user experience and offers great flexibility for app developers to promote app personalization. However, the security implication of Android multitasking remains under-investigated. With a systemic study of the complex tasks dynamics, we find design flaws in Android multitasking which make all recent versions of Android vulnerable to task hijacking attacks. We demonstrate proof of concept examples utilizing the task hijacking attack surface to implement UI spoofing, denial of service, and user monitoring attacks. Attackers may steal login credentials, implement ransomware, and spy on users' activities. We've collected and analyzed over 6.8 million apps from various Android markets. Our analysis shows that the task hijacking risk is prevalent. Since many apps depend on current multitasking design, defeating task hijacking is not easy. We've notified the Android team about these issues, and we discuss possible mitigation techniques in the paper." So this is not news to anybody at Google working on Android. And then I dug a little deeper. I was wondering about this allow task reparenting attribute. So it's in the Android 1.6 SDK. It's called allow task reparenting. And as an example, they said if an activity, and this is from androidcookbook.info, if an activity has its allow task reparenting attribute set to true, it can move from the task it starts in to the task it has an affinity for when that task comes to the fore. And as you could hear, that sounds like exactly what this malware has been designed to do. It creates an affinity bound to some task it wants to impersonate, turns on allow task repairing, and then automatically gets switched into that task's process. They said, for example, and this was the example they give, suppose that an activity that reports weather conditions in selected cities is defined as part of a travel application. It has the same affinity as other activities in the same application, the default affinity, and it allows reparenting. One of your activities starts the weather reporter, so it initially belongs to the same task as your activity. However, when the travel application next comes forward, the weather reporter will be reassigned to and displayed with that task. So, in other words, this has been designed to do this. There is something designed into Google which if malware is allowed to be installed in someone's device without itself needing any permissions, without itself needing any deep access, is able to look around the phone, see what's there, create these affinities, and then impersonate by doing a UI layer, exactly as you said, Leo, a UI layer over the real app in order to obtain the permissions for itself. And that is now being actively exploited in the Google Play Store for any new malware which is installed and does this until it is identified as doing so and then removed. And then, of course, another instance of it is installed under some other name. So I don't know what Google's going to do about this. They know about it. Maybe the fact that this report is now public as of yesterday and this is now getting some real scrutiny. Maybe they have some means in the works to fix it, but haven't implemented it yet. But this, if nothing else, will turn up the heat on them, and that's just all for the good.
We've seen this before, and they didn't fix it last time, as you mentioned, 4 years ago. I think it's because there are major apps like Facebook Messenger, which is you don't use Android, but there's a chat bubble feature, which I really like. If you get a Messenger app chat, a little head will show up in a bubble on top of the screen. Then you can move around, you can tap, you can interact with it. So it is part of its multitasking capability. And I suspect they don't want to turn it off because they don't want to get Facebook angry.
Yeah.
That's not available on Apple. You can't overwrite the screen.
Nope.
There's the peril involved, though. I'm always, I love Android, and I'm very happy with my Orange Pixel 4. I just don't download apps at random.
Correct. That is all the user can. Yes. Yeah. That is our takeaway advice, not for the first time on this podcast, is just if you can stick with well-known mainstream, and don't just download everything that's available because it's free.
You might be tempted by that PDF scanning app. Get the one from Google. Don't get the one from Sleepware or whatever it is.
Right, and the fact that 100 million people have downloaded doesn't mean that it's safe.
Wow, that's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Terrifying. Now, you'd have to be targeted in this attack, or no?
Well, no. And this thing doesn't know who you are. It will find out who you are.
And then contact the servers and say, hey, I have access to Leo's phone. Would you like to see what he's doing right now?
Exactly.
Okay. Jeez Louise. Steve Gibson does it again. I all I can say is if you don't listen to this show, your hard drive could die. That's all. I'm just saying. You got to listen every week to Security Now. You don't have to listen live, although we do it live every Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC. Figure out what your time is and go to twit.tv/live. There's audio and video, so you can listen while you work. Boss will never know. It's good. Actually, the boss should encourage it. It's a good way to keep up on all the perils, risks, and inside and outside baseball stuff with have to do with technology. You can also, if you are listening live, chat with us at irc.twit.tv, always a very active chat room during this show. You can get on-demand versions of the show. Steve's got kind of two unique versions. He has a 64-kilobit audio file, but he also has a 16-kilobit audio file. So if you're on a bandwidth-limited connection, that's a great choice. It's a little scratchier, but at least you get it. He's also got the smallest version of all, which is the fantastic transcripts that Lane Ferris does for him. So you can download and read along as you listen. Those are all available at grc.com while you're there. Steve didn't mention it this week, but pick up a copy of SpinRite. That's his bread and butter and the world's finest hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. Squirrels Official, you can find out more about it. Learn about the API, how you would write a squirrel. I want somebody to work on a squirrel authentication plugin for our Twit forums at twit.community. It's a discourse server, and I think that discourse is widely used. You already have it for Zenforo, and people who use your forums love it.
And also for WordPress.
Yeah.
There is a WordPress plugin. That's, so, yep, we awesome. Need Discus.
Yeah. So Discus would be great. I use Discus. I would use it on my WordPress blog, but I use Discus as the commenting engine on
right.
it.
Right.
And maybe I should just go to native WordPress commenting, and then I could do it. I just don't want to lose all the existing comments. I'll look tonight and see if I can export the Discus stuff into WordPress, because I don't want to use Discus anyway. It's another person watching what you're doing and all of that.
Yeah.
Besides Squirrel, there's all sorts, and SpinRite, there's all sorts of other stuff like Shields Up, lots of free software. It's a rat hole that you'll spend many happy hours perusing. GRC.com. He's on Twitter at SGGRC. And that would be a good place if you have a question or a comment or want to leave a message for Steve. You've got some inside dope. You could direct message him at SGGRC on Twitter. He does not yet have his own Minecraft server. That's just a matter of time, though. No, it's never going to happen. we have on-demand audio and video of every show as well. Video, yeah. So you can see us as well as listen. And that's available at twit.tv/SN, twit.tv/SN. Best thing to do, though, honestly, subscribe. Then you don't even have to think about it. You'll just get it automatically, audio or video, the minute it's done. And if you are subscribing, it helps us because that way we kind of rise through the ranks in the various podcast applications. We're more likely to show up in the Discover tab. So whichever podcast application you use, please do subscribe to Security Now. Steve, you have said this off the air, but I'm going to say it on the air. In a couple of weeks, we're doing the Christmas Eve show.
Ah, yes.
I can't wait. This is going to be a special episode. You want to tell us about it?
Well, I'm noticing that we're starting into a new decade with 2020. So I thought it would be fun to do. I know.
Hard to believe.
I thought it would be fun to do a decade of hacks, looking back over the last 10 years of hacks and attacks,
nice.
And just sort of do a little retrospective of what's everything that we've covered. So we'll deal quickly with any news of the week, and then spend most of our time. Looking back over the past 10 years.
What a decade it has been for security.
Yeah.
That'll be the December 24th edition. We are recording it the day before. We don't want to do it on Christmas Eve, so we're recording that at our usual time, but on Monday the 23rd, just in case you watch live. And then the following week, the New Year's Eve Security Now will be a best-of episode from all the episodes all year long, and we love those best-of episodes. They're always a lot of fun. So, Steve, we'll see you right back here next Tuesday.
Okay, my friend. Till then, thanks. Bye.
Security Now.